Amir Siraj was looking for a meteor.
You know, I was laughing at myself at that point because it sounded so crazy.
At least he was dreaming about it.
I had a lot of dreams for this object, but, you know, most of them felt too silly to talk about.
And not just any meteor. One that had traveled across the universe and was now maybe lying in teeny tiny pieces at the bottom of our ocean. A few years ago, Amir had been a sophomore at Harvard University studying astrophysics. And as part of his work, he combed through a database of meteor impacts supplied by the Department of Defense. And as he did this, he spotted something strange.
I kept getting this one weird result for a meteor that hit the Earth in 2014.
An object moving at an astonishing speed, something about the size of a microwave, that had smashed into Earth's atmosphere at 100,000 miles per hour.
This came down and exploded in the atmosphere about 20 kilometers above the Earth's surface, north of Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. So it was quite a spectacular explosion, I think like 1% of the Hiroshima bomb.
This was not an ordinary space rock. Amir had discovered the first evidence of a meteor that had traveled from outside of our solar system, an interstellar rock that had smashed into us. But for Amir, it was not enough to just know it existed. He wanted to find it. So he started thinking.
It's a crazy idea, but what if we took a boat? Right? What if we took a boat out there and somehow we scooped up some material from the seafloor and saw if we found anything from the meteor?
I'm Dylan Thuris, and this is Atlas Obscura, a daily celebration of the world's strange, incredible, and wondrous places. And today, we are taking a voyage with astrophysicist Amir Siraj. He is returning to the show. We've had him on before to talk about discovering this interstellar object, to tell us the story of the journey he took to the bottom of the ocean in search of something from way, way up above. After this. If you're looking for a place where the wide open skies and the towering mountains inspire you to find an untapped part of yourself, you might want to take a trip to Wyoming. It's a place where bold, curious spirits forge their own way on all types of adventures. There is no shortage of iconic, expansive landscapes out there. You can discover breathtaking hikes, stunning state parks, authentic Western culture, and other historic sites, along with the tales of famous outlaws like Butch Cassidy and pioneers like Buffalo Bill Cody. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? When we come through, it's true magic, because we came to play at Walt Disney World Resort.
For a while, Amir's plan to scour the ocean floor for remnants of this interstellar meteor felt like a ridiculous pipe dream. But
I did some research, and I found that actually something similar has been done once before. This was in 2018. A NASA and NOAA-led team had recovered some meteoritic material from an ordinary meteor from the seafloor.
It gave Amir and his team a glimmer of hope.
You know, this would really be the first time, you know, if we found anything, that humanity could put its hands on a rock from outside of the solar system. And so that opens up a whole new type of science that sort of combines geology with astronomy. And that possibility was just too exciting to turn down.
If the team could actually hunt down the physical remnants of this interstellar meteor, it is an understatement to say that it would be historic. But to do that, they were going to have to navigate some complexities.
The Department of Defense only gave us the location of the meteor to 0.1 degrees in latitude and longitude. And so that basically corresponds to a area of 120 square kilometers. And that is a huge, huge area to survey.
Yeah. Not only are you searching 100 kilometers square, but this object, you said it was about the size of a microwave. It did not come down neatly the size of a microwave.
Yeah, it was traveling at 100,000 miles an hour. Right. So tiny, basically microscopic pieces were scattered all over the ocean.
This is harder than a needle in a haystack. You're searching for like sand grains, specific sand grains, at the bottom of 100 square kilometers in how deep was the ocean?
2,000 meters.
2,000 meters. Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. No problem. As you talk to people about this project, how ambitious was it considered to be, and how confident were you that you were going to find anything down there?
Let's put it this way. You mentioned the needle in the haystack analogy. Imagine if the haystack had a lot of iron in it. And you're searching for the needle with a magnet.
Right.
And there's 100 square kilometers of hay. Yeah. That's what it was like. Yeah. Most people thought that there was zero, absolutely zero chance of us finding anything.
What is the plan for when you get there to find these things?
I figured out that, you know, this thing must have made a lot of sound if it's exploding with 1% of the Hiroshima bomb. And turns out there are stations that record sound all over the globe. They record seismic waves to monitor earthquakes. And something this loud should ostensibly show up in some of these seismic signals. Thankfully, there was a seismic station at Manus Island. Hmm. Checked it, and there it was. You could basically hear the meteor exploding. And I looked around more, and I found there were, albeit faint, signals from the explosion further away. Using these different sonic signatures, we were able to narrow down the search area to a strip about a factor of 10 smaller than the original search area.
They pinpointed where to search, they tracked down a boat, and they had a date on the calendar. And then,
right at the last minute, the owner and operator of the boat said, you know, we got this other contract, and, you know, it was some lucrative business contract, not like the science in the ocean. And they were like, so sorry, we're moving you. And they moved the dates to directly overlap with my sister's wedding, which I was supposed to officiate. So because the expedition overlapped with my sister's wedding, I sort of arrived in the middle. Ah. So I joined everyone on the ship who had been there for several days. And there were a bunch of ocean experts and then a whole engineering operations team. And then there was a documentary film crew there as well, plus the boat staff and, you know, the chefs.
This is a big boat.
It was a big catamaran. It was like a 30-person catamaran. Yeah, it was called the Silver Star. And the way I found pictures of it before we went on the expedition was pictures of it were listed on uglyships.com. But I will say, despite its ugly appearance, I have a very special connection to that boat now. And I trusted it with my life.
Yeah. So what's it like when you get out on the ocean? You know, what's your day like out on the boat?
I mean, first of all, I will say I'm so thankful for the people who told me to start taking the motion sickness medication before you get on the ship.
The boat's moving around. I mean, it's a catamaran. Those things are like not super stable. They like move.
It's rocking. In the shower, you have to hold on to something because otherwise you will fall.
It's like whacking back.
That was the kind of yeah.
Okay.
So I'm trying to get my bearings. I'm going side to side as people are telling me what has happened. Oh, also, the funder was on the boat himself and his bodyguard. So it was
this whole thing. The more you say, the whole thing more sounds like a plot line in like an airport like mystery novel. You know what I mean? Where you open up we're all on the catamaran. The billionaire's there with his bodyguard. We're finding the cosmic remnants of. Anyway, it rules. Okay.
Well, his bodyguards were very nice. The first day I got on the ship, you know, I'd been traveling for 50 hours. So one of the first things I did was, you know, try to shave my burgeoning stubble slash almost beard. And I, you know, I cut myself and just wouldn't stop bleeding. And the bodyguards were the ones who told me, like, Amir, do not shave on a boat. That is the number one rule of being on a boat. You do not shave on a boat. And I followed their advice, didn't get any more cuts, grew out something.
So now it was time for the astrophysicist turned seafarer to find the fragments of this interstellar meteor scattered on the ocean floor. Which begs the question, how are you going to find tiny pieces of meteor on the bottom of the ocean?
When you're working at that kind of depth, 2,000 meters, you know, obviously you can't send a human. Really, you need to cover every square centimeter of seafloor, and you need to do it quickly.
Yeah.
And you need to do it with a machine that's not going to break. So the most sensible solution seemed to be to put down a large slab of stainless steel with very powerful magnets embedded within it. Now, it's a lot harder in practice because, you know, when you have 2 kilometers of depth, it takes a while to let out all that cable. And additionally, you know, when you're towing the ship, you don't know exactly where the sled is.
Right.
And you're just hoping that it didn't get caught behind a rock or that the tension in the cable is correct. And so there was a ton of troubleshooting. So in the first few days, what had happened was there was trouble keeping the sled on the bottom of the ocean. It was basically flying like a kite in the water and not touching the seafloor. And so the engineers were able to fix that problem by basically weighing the sled down, just putting on tons of lead weights. But then, you know, from that point to basically the time that I got on the boat, they had, you know, picked up a bunch of stuff from the seafloor, but you know, what was found was clearly human made, you know, like a piece of a wire, a bolt, you know, those kinds of things.
You guys are basically trash collectors at 2,000 meters at the bottom of the ocean. You're like picking exactly up whatever junk has drifted there.
To be fair, this location was very close to World War II Pacific Theater. Mm-hmm. So it might be old trash, but still trash.
Yeah.
So I start to look at what was found. They're like, here's the piece of a wrench, and here's the wire, here's the paperclip. And I'm thinking we just need to look smaller. Maybe we even have these meteoritic fragments in the stuff we already picked up. Maybe the expedition is going a lot better than we think it is. We think this object was mainly metal. It was mainly iron. When you're traveling at that kind of speed, metal doesn't just fracture. It melts into these kind of raindrops. So it must have been pretty terrifying to be a fish. It starts raining hot iron.
Red hot bullets are like shooting into the water at hypersonic speeds or whatever. Yeah.
But the point is the size of these raindrops, the size of these so-called ablation spherules are tiny. These are not things that you can just pick up with your hand. And so sure enough, within an hour, one of the scientists on the boat who was looking through the material basically used a sieve, and he found the first spherule. And this was just like an unbelievable moment. You know, morale went from like a 0 to 100, right? And then after that moment, both in the runs that were already done and in the future runs, we just kept finding more. Now, I should clarify that just because we found ablation spherules doesn't mean that they came from the object that we're looking for, because lots of meteors hit the Earth all the time. And so there are ablation spherules everywhere on the ocean floor.
So, right, you're finding these things that look right, but could be from any meteorite. How are you going to figure out which ones are from your meteorite?
There are two parts to it. One is these should be metallic, really iron-rich spherules. And so that's something that we could sort of immediately tell from when we got off the boat. The second question of interstellar meteor versus non-interstellar meteor is a far more difficult question that even now, months later, has yet to be answered.
Yeah. So after being out there for a week, you guys collect some material and stuff that looks promising. What was the next step? What did you head home with? What did you actually throw back in the ocean? I assume like the wrenches and wires probably didn't come with you. What did you keep?
Oh, we took some of them.
Nice. Do you have any? Did you bring anything back for yourself? Any like cool little souvenirs?
So whenever the sled would come up, it was a big event.
Yeah.
When the sled would be hauled up onto the deck, because we would basically need all the manpower that we could get to scrape the muck, the magnetic muck off of the magnets and, you know, put them into a container so we can bring them upstairs and start doing magnetic separation. So we had all of these weird plastic implements that we used. Someone's getting a vacuum, you know, to try to vacuum some of the water that we wash it with so we don't lose. I mean, it was like, it was ridiculous. We also brought back some of the, you know, slurry sludge from the last couple of runs when we didn't have time to do that whole process. And so we're basically coming back with a whole lot of dirt and some mud.
Rocks, dirt, and mud is what you ship back. Yeah.
That was, I think, pretty easy to get through customs because they were like, okay, it's just dirt. We went back to Cambridge and basically handed over all of the material that we found to Stein Jacobson, who's a Earth and Planetary Sciences professor at Harvard. And his sort of expertise is in cosmochemistry. That is a real word. I know it sounds ridiculous.
Sounds awesome.
So far, what they've focused on is characterizing the composition. So what elements are in each spherule and in what ratios? And probably the most interesting thing that Stein has found so far is that there seems to be a new class of spherule that we found on the seafloor. These spherules show a different compositional pattern from anything else reported in the literature, and they seem to be enhanced in certain kinds of refractory elements.
It is still way too early to know if any of these tiny blobs came from another star system. We may never know. For Amir, that is okay. He may never know the answer, but the search is the point. This is one piece of an epic scientific journey, crisscrossing the globe to discover more about this planet we live on, the cosmic systems it is one tiny part of, and what is going on in this vast universe we belong to.
I always end up just following what I find is interesting, you know, just following that burning curiosity. And that has landed me in some pretty weird places. So for me, it's more about chasing that scientific thread and seeing where it leads, right? Because that to me is one of the most exciting and thrilling parts of science, is that you can tug on a thread and you can follow it. And, you know, on Earth, nature's had 4.5 billion years, but in general, nature's had 13.8 billion years, right? And we've only been here for, a few hundred thousand, if you're generous, right? So trying to scratch at the surface of some of nature's big mysteries is a pretty great way to spend time. And so if that leads to another boat or something more fantastical, that would be cool.
Yeah.
I guess we'll just have to see.
Just a very quick update on this story, since it is unfolding in real time. In early March, some other scientists not involved in any of this research put a preprint paper up claiming that the seismic data that they had used to determine the search area for the meteorite was wrong. and that one of the seismic signals was actually a truck delivering supplies to a hospital, and that even the sensor data that they had used from the satellites was maybe incorrect, that it was an error, and in fact, the meteorite was not interstellar at all. Just a normal meteorite that crashed in a different place, and what they found on the ocean floor was nothing special. Avi Loeb, Amir's mentor, denies these claims, basically calls them a bunch of armchair hacks who don't know what they're talking about, and says that they have every intention of going back out and looking for even larger pieces of this potentially interstellar meteorite. So it is an active story. It is really quite exciting. It's getting a little catty, and maybe you'll hear another episode about it here on the show. All right, thanks for listening. Our podcast is a co-production of Atlas Obscura and Stitcher Studios. This episode was produced by
Abby Peralt.
The production team includes
Doug Baldinger,
Chris Naka,
Camille Stanley,
Manolo Morales,
Baudelaire,
Gabby Gladney.
Our technical director is
Casey Holford.
This episode was mixed by
Luce Fleming.
Our theme and end credit music is by Sam Tyndall. I'm Dylan Thuris, wishing you all the wonder in the world. I will see you next time.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.